so much. It's been lovely to meet a good number of you already. Ephesians 4 says that Christ has given pastors and teachers to the church, which means whether you feel like this or not, you are a gift from the risen Christ to the people that you're serving. Whether they are always conscious of that or not is another matter, but it's therefore a privilege to be with you these days. When I was preparing for ordination and doing my training, I was getting ready to be ordained in the Church of England. I was going to be a vicar. During that time, a friend of mine back home had a big birthday party. It was fancy dress, so I went back to my hometown. I lack any imagination when it comes to fancy dress, so I borrowed another friend's clerical collar and went as a vicar and was chatting to a group of people I didn't really know. And after a while, one of the girls there said, "Wait a minute, you're not actually a vicar, are you?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Oh, thank goodness for that." And you could sort of see palpable relief among all who were gathered. And then she said, "So what do you do?" I said, "I'm training to be a vicar." Did not go down well. Killed the conversation. But it raises the question of how do you recognize a Christian leader? It's a more serious question than we tend to think. What makes Christian leadership Christian? And I think the answer we often give to that question is where we think, well, if the leader is doing Christian things with the leadership, that makes them a Christian leader. There's this thing called leadership. Politicians use it to win elections and stay in power. CEOs use this thing called leadership to make their companies financially successful. And pastors use this thing called leadership to make churches grow. And so we tend to think, well, what makes leadership Christian is what it's being used for. If it's being used to gospel ends, then we think it's Christian leadership. And that's not untrue, but I think it is dangerously incomplete. Because it strikes me from the passage we'll be looking at today and other places as well, that what makes Christian leadership Christian isn't just where you're leading people, but how you're leading people. It's not just the ends, but the means. And I think it's too easy to overlook this. John mentioned earlier the sort of series of scandals and leadership failures we've seen in the UK over recent years. And it feels as though every evangelical network is having some kind of reckoning. And I'm sure there's a lot of reasons why and a lot of factors and a lot of things to unpick from all of that. But I wonder if one of the factors is we're often sometimes so focused on the brilliance of where leaders are taking us. They're people who get things done, who make things happen, who get churches planted, who get people trained up, that we often fail to see the deficiencies in how they are leading. And we tend to focus on the effectiveness of the leadership rather than the manner. And we need both, as Richard has been reminding us. We tend to be more focused on the outcomes than the character. Paul Tripp's wonderful book on leadership is over on the bookstore. One of the things Paul says there is this. He says, our definition of a leader now is strong personality, quick-witted, forceful, domineering, able to win the day in a discussion or argument, can cast vision and collect people. No wonder we've produced a culture of ministry bullies who mistreat people. So we need to come to Mark chapter 10. We need to come in humility, perhaps even in desperation, and learn again what Jesus has to say to us here. So let me read from Mark 10, verse 35. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And Jesus said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We're able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or my left hand is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. For whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Three very unsophisticated headings. We're going to think about the world, the church, and the Lord. So we think about the world. This whole thing is kicked off by James and John. They make this request of Jesus, verse 35. "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you," which isn't a great start in terms of your posture before the Lord. But before we are too quick to judge them, we need to recognize that this very same tendency exists in our hearts as well. They give Jesus this request in verse 37, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." They know Jesus is about to enter some form of glory. There's been talk of a kingdom. There's something going on. They don't quite understand what. But things are about to happen, and they want to get in on it first. So they say to Jesus, "Listen, whenever this all kicks off, one of us at your right, one of us at your left. We'll be in the kind of the prime positions." And so they're really asking Jesus to make them great. And the fact that Jesus then turns this request into a lesson for all of the disciples means we mustn't think that we're above it ourselves. We're told that when the 10 hear about this, they began to be indignant, not because this is such an inappropriate thing to ask Jesus. I'm sure they were indignant because James and John got there first. And the fact is, they are missing the point of Jesus' death. They're missing the point of what his glory consists in. And what they miss, we need to assume we are equally capable of missing. So Jesus pulls all of them to him and begins to teach on this in verse 42. "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them." Jesus is making now an observation from the world around us. Jesus says, this is how it is. Those who are considered rulers lord it over, they exercise authority. This is what people do with power. People use power to assert themselves over others, to put themselves above others, to make themselves feel superior and to make others feel inferior. And it happens at every level of authority and power. From the prime minister to the traffic warden, give someone power and they will find some way of lording it over others and reminding you that they're the ones in authority here. And it's about putting people in their place, and that place is always beneath you. It's about pulling rank. It's making sure everyone knows who the top dog is. It's about superiority. And the fact that Jesus says, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles do this," Jesus is saying, listen, we all know this. We see this. This is not a state secret. This is something we all observe around us. It's the way of the world. He doesn't need to prove this to us. In every age, in every culture, this is how things are. We use power to aggrandize ourselves and to belittle others. So that's the world, but the church is to be different, because Jesus says in verse 43, "It shall not be so among you." Jesus does not tell us to withdraw from all forms of leadership and authority. We need those things. We need rulers. We need power. But he is going to call us to approach these things in a totally different way to the world around us. And so that tendency that is the default setting for the rest of the world is not to be what marks us in verse 43. And because that is the natural way of the world, we have to assume it will always be our tendency to drift into it. In other words, because this is the way the world works, it will take no effort to be like the world and every effort not to be. And so part of what we need to do is make sure we can begin to identify the ways in which we feel that tug to be lording it over others. The Old Testament shows us that this isn't new. These worldly forms of leadership have come into the people of God before. We heard a bit from Ezekiel 34 earlier from the work that God has called shepherds of his people to. But just earlier in that same passage, we have the diagnosis of those who've been falsely shepherding the people. And part of the indictment is this in Ezekiel 34, verses 3 and 4. God says to these false shepherds, "You do not feed the sheep. The weak you have not strengthened. The sick you have not healed. The injured you have not bound up. The strayed you have not brought back. The lost you have not sought. And with force and harshness you have ruled them." In other words, they were leading like the rulers of the Gentiles do. There were people who were lording it over the people of God. This is not new. And we need to assume it will be just as much a danger for us as it was for them. Now, part of the issue, I think, for us is that there are obvious dramatic examples of this that we're all familiar with. There are the notorious pastors who we all know the names of, who have been caught in various forms of oppressive leadership. There's been headlines and investigations and suspensions and firings and so on. And it's sometimes tempting for us to think, well, I'm not like that, so therefore I'm okay. But it doesn't have to be dramatic to be a problem. We don't have to be going that far to be doing this. It can happen on a much smaller scale. This is a heart issue. God said there in Ezekiel 34, with force and harshness you have ruled. There are subtle ways to be harsh. There are lots of undramatic ways we can lord it over others. We might have our own subtle ways of putting people in their place. I know of one pastor who, when he had new staff members join the team, he was evidently a very good squash player, so he would always play squash with a new staff member and beat them to put them in their place. I can't hit a ball to save my life, so that's never going to be my thing. But we all have our own little subtle ways of trying to assert ourselves over others. And with that example, no one's going to call the police. No one's going to call for an investigation because someone beat his staff at squash. But it's serious. It's lording it over. The role of the leader is not to put people in their place. Or rather, the place we should be putting people in is above us and not below us. There are lots and lots, and you will know, I can't remember how many one another verses we have in the New Testament. A friend of mine pointed out in a conversation recently, he said, we're never told to humble one another. We're told to humble ourselves. But I think it's one of the ways we justify this kind of lording it over, is we think, well, I'm just humbling this other person. Peter says something similar in 1 Peter chapter 5. Peter talks about the work of an under-shepherd, and he says in verses 1 to 3 of 1 Peter 5, he says, "Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock." There's a lot there we could meditate on. Again, there is a right place for oversight. There are those who are in our charge. But Peter gives three contrasts. He says you're to serve willingly, not under compulsion. You're to be serving eagerly and not for shameful gain. And you're to be leading by example and not by coercion. It is possible to lead people. It is possible to move people from A to B by using hierarchy and your position. We can make people do things through intimidation, through coercion, through threats, and through bullying. I remember a pastor telling me once he was needing to recruit some new small group leaders, story of our lives, and he's naturally a very big personality, and he said there was one particular couple he had asked if they would consider, and they said, "We can't do it." He said, "So I made them." And at the time I was thinking, wow, strong leader. I now wonder if that was actually a failure of leadership rather than a good example of it. It is possible for the flock to do things, to assent to things by compulsion rather than the work of the Spirit. In Romans 14, verse 23, Paul says, he's talking about those who are weak in faith. He says, "Whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith." Paul is talking about people who are abstaining from certain foods, even though God doesn't require them to, but it's become a conscience issue. And if they're made to doubt their conscience, he says, "Whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith, for whatever does not proceed from faith is sin." In other words, if someone has a conscience issue over something they needn't have a conscience issue over, they shouldn't be coerced into changing their practice. But Paul makes it a wider thing. He says, whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. In other words, if people believe certain theological truths, if people behave in certain ways simply because the pastor has pushed them into it, it has not come from faith. And whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. It's not the Spirit of Christ who has moved them into those beliefs or practices. It's the forcefulness of a leader, which is dangerous, because once the leader moves on or they move to another church, the reason they now have for believing the right things or doing the right things has been taken away. It's not their faith that has been moving them. So the church is not to be like the world. It shall not be so among you. But Jesus then gives us the positive. "But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all." In other words, Jesus wants to flip the whole thing. We're going to redefine what it means to be great. Being great isn't the person at the top of the pyramid lording it over all the other people. What is great now is the person at the bottom, serving all the other people above him. And Jesus himself is the reason for this. Verse 45, famously, Jesus says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Jesus is calling us to a different kind of leadership. Costly love, sacrificial leadership, cruciform leadership, where we put the needs of others before ourselves. And the model is Jesus himself. The Son of Man came to serve. Jesus is a servant. It's defining of him. Throughout the Gospels, we see Jesus consciously applying the servant language of Isaiah to himself. This is not an incidental part of his ministry. It's not something he does on the side. It's not like when you work part-time as a waiter as well as doing something else. This is who Jesus is. He is a servant. It's defining. At the Last Supper in Luke's account, Jesus says, "I stand among you as one who serves." That is who he is. And of course, he's not just a servant, he is the servant. He's the ultimate servant because he serves at greatest cost to himself. He gives his life. And he does so to meet our greatest need, to be the ransom we could never have provided ourselves. And in so doing, he is also the pattern for us. Notice the word "even" there in verse 45, "for even the Son of Man." Why does he say "even the Son of Man"? Because the one who you might expect to have legitimately come to be served was the Son of Man. This is the one God has given all authority to in the Old Testament, the one who's going to run the universe on God's behalf. And so if even the Son of Man didn't come to be a big deal and to be served, how much more should our mentality be, "Well, I'm not here to be served, but to be a servant." And we see this attitude beginning to shape the people of God. So the apostles all identify themselves as servants. Paul, Peter, John all introduce themselves as servants. That's what they are, first and foremost. Even James and Jude, who could have made much of being half-brothers of Jesus, even they define themselves first and foremost as servants. In Revelation chapter 2, Jesus refers to all of his people as "my servants." Some of you will know Andrew Wilson, wonderful pastor and thinker down in London. He once tweeted this. Occasionally, Twitter is not entirely horrific. But he tweeted this. He said, "Jesus was a slave, so Christians are slaves of the slave, which makes pastors slaves of the slaves of the slave." Which gives us no excuse for pride, for big dealness, for swagger, for grandiosity. And if we fail to see our leadership as a form of service, we're not just misunderstanding our role, we're actually misrepresenting Jesus. We're meant to be reflecting who he is. Jesus is the good shepherd. We are described as under shepherds, and there's meant to be a correspondence between our shepherding and his shepherding. People are meant to be able to read off from our leadership the kind of leader Jesus is. In Matthew 11, 28-30, Jesus famously describes himself as being gentle and lowly of heart. We're used to Jesus showing us what our hearts are like. Spurgeon says this is the only place where Jesus shows us what his own heart is like. He rips open his chest and shows us his heart. And he says he is gentle and lowly of heart. That is who he is at the very core of his being. And so part of our calling as his servants, as his under shepherds, is to lead in such a way that makes it obvious to people that is what the heart of Jesus is like. People should be able to tell from the way we are to them what Jesus is like to them. So an uncomfortable question to ask ourselves is, as people look at our leadership, what are they going to be concluding about the heart of Jesus? When that book, Gentle and Lowly, came out a couple of years ago, there were so many people I met who said they were surprised at its message. And now it was written in a very vivid and fresh way, but it made me think, it's not been obvious from many of our ministry practices that this is what Jesus has always been like. And I sometimes wonder if people were to look at our ministries and try and extrapolate what the heart of Jesus is like, would they come up with gentle and lowly? Or would it be pushy and demanding or something else? And the point is this, if we're not leading in that cruciform Christ-like way, then we're actually unpreaching in the way we lead the very message that we're seeking to lead people into. Which means we just won't be able to be effective. But if we serve as Jesus serves, if we embody the character of the Good Shepherd, that's real power. Back in 1 Peter 5, he said not to be domineering, but to lead by example. There's something more compelling than being shoved by someone, and that's being inspired by someone. And it's interesting here in Mark 10 that I'm sure this is not me reading too much into this, but Jesus says in verse 42, he doesn't describe the rulers of the Gentiles as rulers. He says those who are considered rulers. And I think he's making this point. They look like they're the ones with power. They look like they're the ones with significance. They look like they're the ones shaping the course of history and changing the world. But perhaps we're meant to realize they are considered rulers of the Gentiles. But the real action is somewhere else. There's a far more powerful force at work in the world than our political leaders and all the pushing and shoving that they do. Because Jesus says, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be the slave of all. And the more we embrace that, actually the more power we have. But it's not power for us, it's power of Christ for the sake of others. If you lord it over someone, you can change their behavior, you can make them do things. But if we serve like Jesus does, we're not just changing people's behavior, we're changing people's hearts. I was trying to think through how to apply some of these things, and I realized it's such a personal issue. The way each of our own hearts will stray towards that lording it over tendency, it'll look different for each one of us. So I suggest as we go into groups to pray now that we have as one of the things we reflect on, where is this tendency in me? Let's assume it is in us because it's the way of the world, it's the way of the flesh. And ask the Lord to show us in our own hearts and to be inspired again to be like Jesus, to see the beauty of his service. And to realize, actually, that's what we want to be. Let me pray. Father, it feels so kind of trite and inadequate to say thank you for Jesus, but we do. We do thank you for Jesus. We thank you that he came into this world even as its creator and ruler to serve us. That Jesus could look at each one of us and consider us worth his while serving. And Father, we pray that that would so captivate our hearts that we want nothing more than to be like him. So please help us to put to death every craving in our heart to lord it over others, to put others beneath us. Show us where that tendency is. And may we be those who lead like Jesus does, who make it obvious to those that we serve what the Good Shepherd is really like. Help us not to be an example of a false Christ, but to embody the heart of the one who is gentle and lowly. And we pray in his name. Amen.